Welcome everybody to conference call number 147 with Revi, sponsored by the National Council of Young Israel. Revi.
Thank you so much. Question number one. Someone in shul had yahrzeit this past Shabbos and wanted to have maftir and daven musaf. When Shabbos came, he was the only Levi in the shul. What was done is that he was given Levi. They read the Haftorah from a Tanakh, so someone else was called up for maftir, and he read the Haftorah, he meaning the, assuming the person who had yahrzeit. If such a thing happens, again, what can we do? So, there are two choices. The Ramah writes in Siman Reish Pei Dalad Siv Dalad that this idea that Reuven should share the brachas and Shimon should read the Haftorah is less than ideal. Less than ideal. And it's interesting to, at first glance, call a Levi twice. Might be permissible. Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Kuf Mem Dalad, Siv Dalad, it's impermissible from two Sifrei Torah, may lead to a conclusion if the first one is possible. But the Ramah writes in Siman Reish Pei Bei Sif Hei, quote, Lo Yafter Misha'ola Kvar. So, either way, you're not in a lechatzila situation. To call someone twice is not a lechatzila. And to have someone read and someone else make the brachos is also not a lechatzila. So the Pisket Shuvah is there, and Oz Tess has an interesting suggestion for a Kohen. Ask him to walk out. So he walks out. So then someone else gets the aliyah, he'll get mafter. That won't work for a Levi. If a Levi walks out, then the Kohen will get two aliyahs, which is also not ideal. So it didn't gain much. It seems to me that what the people did was certainly a proper alternative, even though other alternatives do exist. Question two. It's an involved question that needs to be asked. Our congregation is currently dwindling. That could change, of course, but we must deal with the current reality. On Friday nights, we had an average of 6 men. We should start at 7 p.m. in the summer. Someone to start at 6:45 p.m. The two octogenarians, is that relevant to the Pesach? Could we daven marvel early without a minion? If so, how early? How early can we count Omer? Is it better to send people home for marv, considering that some might not daven at all? On Shabbos day, we usually get a minion late in the morning. We start at 8:45 and might not get the 10th man waltzing in 9:15, just before Shochanan. Oftentimes, we get a minion even in later after Amidah, leading to a lack of Chazaras HaShas. We do not get a minion for Mincha unless we start immediately after the Kiddush, which is what we do in the winter. In the summer, is there any way we can daven Mincha earlier than this Zman? Here's the answer. You can daven Marv as early as Plaga Mincha, which is an hour and a quarter of relative hours, which is more than that, about an hour and a half in the summertime in June in New York City. However, Sfira can only be said after Shkia. It's very hard to be Makel before that, although there's some are willing to do so. We don't accept that, really. And it's better after Tetzko Chavim. But there should be no one to be, should be sent home. The person who can go home, if he wants, there's no minion anyway. But the idea of sending someone home doesn't sound right to me. And the answer to the last question, can you daven Mincha before the Zman? Absolutely not. So you have to manage as best as you can in your situation. Three, what are the parameters of reciting Birchas Agama? Three examples of questions. One, A, the person falls and needs stitches, but it could have been a lot worse to the bench Gaimel. B, woman had a miscarriage of 10 weeks, does she bench Gaimel? C, when people fly to and from Israel. D, when a person has the last aliyah, would the person say Birchas Agama before or after Kaddish? So, here's my answer to this question. It's a difficult question. Seems to me that a person should not bench Gaimel if he needs stitches. Could have been a lot worse. You know, they quote from Rav Moshe Bick, a humorous response. someone said, I was standing on the sidewalk, I was about to walk onto the street, and a car came flying by. Had I been in the street, I would have been in danger. He was supposed to have answered like this. Yesterday, I was looking out the window from my upper floor. I was about to go to sleep. I had my pajamas in my hand. My pajamas fell out of the window. Had I been in the pajamas, I would have been in danger. Obviously, a humorous response. But the point was that you don't make hagomo just because it could have been worse. That's not sufficient reason. Question number two is an interesting question. The Piskei Tshuvos, the Siman Reish Yutes, footnote 50, quotes from Shlomo Zalman, that the minhag is not to make after a miscarriage. Some have a minhag that women never make bench gomel because there's a problem of a minyan, the tznius, etc., etc. Seems to me that she wants to bench gomel, she may, even after a miscarriage. But if she doesn't want to, she can rely upon the other opinions. There are many women who refuse to bench gomel after they give birth, even though I think they really should, because there is a greater level of tznius that they have. Although in our shul, I always encourage them to bench gomel after childbirth or any other incident. The way we do it, after davening is over, stand by the mechitza, pull down the mechitza, and she says in a loud voice, bench gomel, and 10 men are gathered within earshot, and that's how it's done. I think it's a good idea, but again, the tznius of women should be kept in mind. Next question. Flying up to Israel. My view is that it should not bench gomel. The Piskei Tshuvos, footnote 18, quotes from Velvel Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav said that way, and many others. But can't deny the fact, as he has in the previous footnotes, that the minhag ha'olam in many places is that they do bench gomel if they fly over the water. Rav Moshe said you have to bench gomel whenever you fly. You fly from New York to Boston. Well, not maybe go over the water. You went from New York to Chicago. So there's no water. Might still have to bench gomel because you were in a dangerous situation. The plane has a bad incident. That's quoted in the Dershu there, footnote 3. Seems to me it's better not to bench gomel because it's not considered dangerous anymore. But those who want to do it, especially if it's going over the water, have certainly what to rely upon. If Kaddish is being said that day, she'll look at the Piskei Tshuvos, footnote 71. He says the bench gomel before Kaddish. Okay. And that comes the hardest question. Question four. So I go over the halachas associated with opening bottles and cans on Shabbos. A, soda bottles. B, soda cans. C, can a tuna fish or vegetables with a can opener, with a flip cap. Orange juice or milk. Old star with the flaps. New star with the cover and a colorful ring to pull off. Would it make a difference if you saved covers open during the week and throw out the covers on Shabbos and use the old covers? What to do in a house where they open such a bottle that I think it should not? On Shabbos, surprise guests come to Shalosh Shudas. Host wants to make tuna fish. He explained the permissible way of how to do it from opening the can opener, pressing the metal lid to drain out the excess oil from the tuna, add mayo and mixing it up. That's a whole safer for this. But go slowly. First question. In this Dirshu, Simon Shin Yudalad, footnote 20, they only quote the strict opinion. Strict opinion, you can't open soda bottles. We're talking about the soda bottles with the twist off, not the old type where you just took a opener and pulled up one little piece on the side and bent a little bit. Not everyone agrees with mutter. They say you can't do it, either because it's mechatech, some say, or most folks would say it's makam bepatish, you're creating a kli. Shlomo Zalman has this remarkable distinction between plastic and metal, which is very helpful. Most soda bottles, they have plastic on top. He said that's mutter, and metal is also. Rav Yoshev says even plastic is also. He's worried about mechatech. Most folks don't hold for mechatech in this particular context. Remarkably, Piskei Tshuvos, their Shin Yudal, footnote 65, quotes many, many people who are mater metal. I thought that was correct. I hope my Sefer Am Mordechai and Shabbos, page Kuf Samech Aleph, explains why. And the real reason is It was a kli and it's still a kli. It was considered a kli before, considered a kli now. Just changed the use from being someone that holds all the air in very tight, something which forfeits some of that, but can then now open and close. Quoted there from Ilfus and Charonios and Gemara and Beitza, which seems to be exactly this case. Bavadja passes the kula and many others. My view is that it's permissible, but others think that it's not. Okay, this is as far as the soda bottles are concerned. The soda cans, here it's flipped. Shlomo Zalman is Mekel, called by the Dirshu there, footnote 27, and he explains because the soda can is thrown out into the garbage as soon as you finish the soda, so therefore there's no consequence. I thought, doesn't matter. There's a special Easter called making a Pesach Yofer. A Pesach Yofer is an independent prohibition which exists even in something which you throw out, which I explained there in my Sefer, page Kuf and Tes and Kuf Samach, why I think it's a problem. You know, a Pesach Yofer means something which is a specialized shape. And as I always say, the R&D, which went into the development of the perfect shape for the Coca-Cola can, I'm sure was significant. Just big enough and the right shape if a person wants to drink from the can. And if you want to pour it out, it shouldn't be too much or too little. So I believe it's a very serious problem. There is an Eitzah. This is found by Rabbi Tzion Abba Shaul in his Sefer. He also thinks it's a problem. But if you don't open it all the way, if you open it only halfway, absolutely not a Pesach Yofer. You can't drink from it, really. And it's going to come out gumbu, 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 gumbu. Not the way they would like to do it with the full opening. That's not a Pesach Yofer. So then we can permit it if someone needs to have some Coca-Cola. Next question. In the Pesach Shuvos there, in Oz Beis, there's three different cases of these kinds of cans. One, you throw it out immediately. Two, you keep it till you finish all the contents and then you throw it out. Three, you keep it for second use after you empty it out. He paskins over there as follows. He paskins that the first case is mutter. That was thrown out right away. The second is that it's meant to be used repeatedly. That's also. But if it's going to just empty out the contents, and then that's a question. These days, it's almost always thrown out immediately. People used to keep the half tuna can remains. They had this mercury poisoning. Gotta take it out, put it into a Tupperware dish. And even if it's the middle category, we think that's also mutter. Now, how you open it is a good question. Flip cap. It's all the same thing. We don't view it as a Pesach Yofer. You know why? You're removing the entire cover. Whether it be a flip tap or a can opener, it's all the same thing. You're taking the entire top off. That's not a Pesach Yofer. You just took the whole thing off. It's not a special shape. It's removed the cover completely. So I think it's also mutter, based on what we said a few moments ago. Now we go a little bit further. What do you do in the case of the orange juice or milk old saw with the flaps? Here, Pesach Shuvos, footnote 21, because it's mutter, because you're throwing it out afterwards. And the Dirshu, footnote 16, also of Moshe, thinks that it's also. I also think it's also. In my Sefer, page Kuf Samach, I explain why it's also. Not exactly where Moshe said it's also. It's a different reason. I believe that this is a first-time spout, which never existed until you pull the flaps apart. Based on my observation, you had a milk factory here in Riverdale, which I used to look at. And therefore, it's also a marze, which the Gemara prohibits also. It's making a kind of a spout, a funnel, So I don't think it's permissible at all. But others disagree. It sounds like it's a daraisa. But again, something is mutter. Next question. You have to worry about the new star with the cover and a colorful ring to pull off. So once again, the Piskei Shuvos, footnote 24, is worried about mechatech. We don't think it's mechatech at all. And therefore, it's probably mutter. But as I said before, you're removing the entire piece with the ring. But one can argue, not the entire cover of the tuna can. Here it's an entire little space, which might be construed as a Pesach Yofa. I don't really think so, but since it may be Pesach Yofa, I would try to avoid opening these things on Shabbos. Rather, what I tell you is open it before Shabbos. The same as our moisturizer about the tuna cans. Things are smoother because the can is bottled to the contents. But it's better before Shabbos. So the same with the orange juice. Only time I don't say better before Shabbos is with the soda bottle, because soda bottles lose their fizz before Shabbos. So I think there's nothing wrong with opening them on Shabbos if you want to enjoy the soda for opening Shabbos. Now, what about the idea of having other covers, which you're going to let you throw this cover out and use the stock that you have from during the week? Shmir Shabbos Kuchosa and Perek Tes, footnote Samach Aleph, says it's perhaps mutter, based on the Gemara in Masechta Sukkah, that something is not considered to be a tikkun by removing berries to be makshuit as a hadas for the Arba Minim. If you have other hadasim, so here too, if you have other bottle caps, you don't need this, you're throwing it out. That's a good svara, I think. Although, based on what I said, you don't even need this svara. That's what he says. What happens? People don't keep your strictures and you're in the house for Shabbos. Look, we explained before that almost every case has somebody's makel on it. And even though you don't agree with it, but they have a right to rely on the more lenient view. Even for me, that I disagree, I can still drink the soda. I can still have the whatever they procured by what I think is a prohibited action, because I'm not the only person in the world. Whenever there's a machloikis, there's no issue of Maaser Shabbos. If you look at Mishnah Berurah, Siman Shin Yud Ches of Korban Beis, here there's a machloikis about just about everything. What about the tuna? You have guests. What do you do with the tuna? So opening it, we said before, is permissible. To strain it, by pressing the cover and having the liquid come out. Piskei Shuvos, Siman Shin Yud Ches, footnote 311, says it's not allowed, based upon Rav Moshe. However, in footnote 313, he says, some say no, it's not considered a kli borer. It's not a vessel made to select. Instead of your hands, you want to get your hands dirty or wet, you're putting in this little cover of the can. And therefore, there were those who say that's considered biyad. Now, we all know in Hilchos Borer, biyad is permissible only if it's what we call ochel mitoch psoles, good from the bed. Big dispute in this kind of a case. What's considered mitoch what? That's a whole argument. If I'm holding my hand and something comes out, What am I doing? Am I taking what's in my hand away from what's being spilled out, or the other way around? That's discussed in there in the same chapter, footnotes 331 and 32. What is it? If you view it as psoles mitoch ochel, because the juice is garbage, you're taking that out, would be prohibited. But if you say, no, I'm taking the contents in my right hand, the tuna can, separating it from the juice that's going to come out, ochel mitoch psoles, then it would be permissible according to that opinion. It's considered like biyad. What about adding mayonnaise? Oh, Shmir Shabbos Kuchosa Perakhes Ha'ara Pe'alef is a fascinating footnote. The minig is to be mekel, even though he's not exactly sure why. You don't know, that's just in course a few different various for us. In Piskei Shuvos, Shin Chof Aleph, Sif Chof Zion, footnote 284, he says it's not called Lisha. Lisha means kneading. Here, it's just a dibuk, making a block out of it. So that's the minig Yisrael, which is to be permissive, even though there are those who don't understand why it should be so. Let's go on further. Question number five. A Jewish dentist owns a dental practice which has always been closed on Shabbos and Yom Tov. A month ago, he hired a non-Jewish dentist as an associate. The associate sees a patient, and the Jewish dentist receives a percentage of the profit. The new associate is unhappy by losing the potential of on Yom Tov. He tells the dentist he wants to see patients on Yom Tov. The practice is under the name of the Jewish dentist, but it is in a medical building in a non-Jewish area. The non-Jewish associate would run everything on Yom Tov, meaning the non-Jew would pay the non-Jewish staff and receive all of the profits from the Yom Tov work. The non-Jew would be doing this entirely on his own volition and discretion. May the Jew allow it to happen? Is any sort of written agreement required? Well, here in this case, you're not him to open. There's no Easter of Amir Lenachri. He's not having any benefit from it. He's not getting a nickel. There's no Maris Ayin, because they're the non-Jewish section. No Easter of Schar Shabbos, because he's not getting paid. We're going to the non-Jew. Therefore, it seems to me that it's permissible, as long as it should be kept quiet as much as possible in the from community. Question six. My Kiddush committee has chicken nuggets which are initially cooked via frying. They want to leave them in the fridge to start a Shabbos, take them out to get room temperature on Shabbos morning, then take sauce that has been in the warmer all Shabbos and ladle it on them when Kiddush starts. Using the ladle as a cliché, would we be concerned that these are Kali Abishal, especially since they are no longer raw and therefore subject to Yesh Bishal Achar Tiglin? Good question. Number one, we should caution when you view that the label is a cliché, not everyone agrees, but Chazanish in one place suggests that if you ladle it out after it's got off the fire, then everyone should agree it's considered cliché, that's what should be done. Don't ladle it on the fire, but only off the fire. So you have cliché. Fine. Seems to me that in this case, the people who are ladling the hot gravy are not trying to take this hot sauce and change the taste of the chicken nuggets. There's something on top which adds a measure of heat and a measure of its own taste. Therefore, if they're not changing the taste of the chicken nuggets, there are many poskim who are lenient. There's no psik reisha of cooking at all, both from the halachic perspective, where some say that there is ein bishul achar tikun, and from the physical perspective, because it's not so hot, it's there for a short time, doesn't change the taste. So therefore, it seems to me this should be permissible. Seven. I buy a video, when I turn it on, it says that only I could watch it, and I cannot show it to someone outside my house. Is this conditional legally binding, or can I conduct myself as the owner of the video? I recommend you to a sefer called Emek HaMishpat Zuchuyos HaYotzrim. Pages, 800 pages, big fat book about this. Two relevant pages, page Tuf Resh Nun Hey, and says that according to those who say that there's no bias, there's no ownership on something which you create, this is itself the subject of hundreds of pages in that book. I subscribe to the more lenient view in this matter. Then a tanai, a condition, will not be effective, nor will something on page Tov Resh Ayin Ches called a shiur, shinyun v'resh, you know, withholding part of the ownership. He writes convincingly that those two things both don't work. So again, if you go with the understanding that there's ownership of intellectual property, then you can't do anything. But if you don't accept that, then the fact that they write that doesn't work. It doesn't make a difference. However, we're only matir for private use, not to make profit on the deal. That'd be called hasagas gvul, and would probably also be prohibited according to the law of the land. Most authorities assume the law of the land would not prohibit automatically any private use of something which has copyrights, etc. There are different laws in different states. There's also an assumption, you know, for just to give an example, which is written in that Sefer, that is, it says in all these books, you can't copy anything. They're totally prohibited. But in every single yeshiva, the person wants a one page for his class, so they copy from, who knows, a Siddur, a Chumash. It's assumed that this is permissible and probably by law and probably by Minhag HaMedina and probably by Halacha as well. So we have to be careful in what you prohibit in these areas. We now go to question number 8. I recently attended a wedding where the person reading the Ksuba paused in the middle, seemingly for a missing name. What should the Rav who was reading the Ksuba do in that situation without creating too much of a tumult or embarrassment of the Chosn, Kala, and Masada Kiddush? Just keep on reading. Keep on reading. That's what you should do, as if nothing is wrong. After you finish reading, you tell the Masada Kiddush, there's a name missing over here. Let the Masada paskin what to do. Is it kosher b'di'evit or not? Every case is different, but what's left out, what's in. And if he passes that it's not okay, you write a new ksuba. That's what should happen. These things happen, by the way, in more than one case. I got a question just last night about a ksuba with the wrong place, apparently. And what do you do about that? As I said, the rabbi has to paskin. And if he paskin that it's no good, you write a new ksuba. If it's discovered shortly after the chuppah, the two witnesses who saw the Kabbalah's kinyan are still there, they can start a new ksuba based on what they saw earlier. These are interesting situations. Number 9. If someone vomited after eating part of a suda on Shabbos, does he have to bench? If he feels up to it, must he eat another suda to make up for the one that he threw up? What would be the halacha if he happened after he ate the matzah on the Pesach or after he ate the sukkah on the first night of Sukkot? 3 different questions. The Dirshu, Siman Kuf Pei Dalet, end of footnote 13, quotes a machloikas. Not surprisingly, there are those who say, should I make a bracha? Why? It says in the Gemara, if a person waited until after the food is digested, it's too late to make a bracha afterwards. This is even worse. It never really got digested in the first place. Therefore, you should not make a bracha after you threw it up. That's what some say. Others disagree. They say no. If you look in Siman Resh Yud, there in the Dirshu, footnote 16, the Pirkei Tshuvos, Siman Kuf Pei Dalet, and footnote 32, and some say no, you do make a bracha. It's called Hanaz Goron. That's all you need. That's considered the definition of Achila. Now, if on the other hand, you have an opportunity to eat more, another Suda, you certainly should, because it's not a perfect fulfillment of Suda Shabbos, even if it's a B'di'evin fulfillment. This is pointed out in Pirkei Tshuvos in the Reish Mem Beis, footnote 57. You have an onus Shabbos that he calls Kahogen, which includes the fact that your stomach is satiated. What about matzah? So in Siman Tov Ayin Hey, Sipe, and footnote 70, he quotes out the Minchas Chinuch and the Tzipesach and the Stipler, Ulod Yotza. It doesn't matter. He threw up the matzah afterwards. He had a Noz Goron, which is critical. However, he does quote that there is a dissenting view, the Mekor Chaim, beginning of Siman Tov Nun Dalet, who says that's a problem. And it's certainly true, he writes there in Pirkei Tshuvos, if someone does it on purpose. How on purpose? Why on purpose? Ah, we have this recurring problem. Someone who has serious celiac, and anytime you have your stomach is affected by wheat, it's a disaster. Oh, a great idea. Chew the matzah, and then, great idea. After you swallow it, you find a way how to vomit it quickly so it will not affect your stomach. that would certainly be no good, because there you have it premeditatedly. But even if not, according to the Makor Chaim, it's not a proper way to fulfill the mitzvah. Therefore, if a person by mistake threw it up, and he still feels okay, if he's a sign of sickness, he shouldn't be doing it again. But if it's just someone just happened to come up, just took a bad swallow or something, then they should try to do it again, if it's possible. Okay, question number 11. On Friday night after davening, a mitzvah went to the shul's coat room to take his raincoat as missing. He's the last person in shul, and it's raining outside. Apparently someone else took this mitzvah's coat and left his own behind. They look exactly the same, but the mitzvah's coat has a name in it, and the remaining coat has no name in it. May the mitzvah wear the remaining coat and bring it back in the morning. Not so simple. Not so simple. Oh, I skipped the question. I'll come back to it in a minute. Not so simple. Because on the one hand, I think it's an umna de muchach that the one who took the coat would give permission to the other fellow. He shouldn't get drenched in the rain. And they'll switch it back again in the morning. So when they both come down in the same shul. Now, what happens if he doesn't come back? So you who took this nameless coat have to make every effort to identify who it is as soon as possible. In that case, it sounds like maybe the machlokas between Tosfos and the Shach. Tosfos in Bava Metzia, Chav Beis on the bottom, calls this Yir Shelo Midas. The person who left his coat behind doesn't know that, and therefore, even if he knew about it, he might say, well, let's just give it up and let someone else take it. He doesn't know about it. The Shach says if it's an umdun and muchach, we know for sure he wouldn't mind, then it's okay. And that's what many posts rely upon the Shach. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishra, Simon Kuf Lamed Vav Tif Aleph, quoting Mabba Babasha, Mem Vav Amanav, the Schalfu Lo Kelev Abeis Uman, which you're not allowed to take it. So at first glance, here you should just leave it, but you get drenched. So the Aruch HaShulchan writes there in Choshen Mishra, Kuf Lamed Vav, end of Siv Beis, if you're in a shul, or similar setting, and they didn't have shank coats, and they had these boots, because there was a lot of mud. And if the guy took his boots, you're not supposed to daven in boots, because you wouldn't walk into someone's house in boots. They left, used to leave their boots outside, and someone took someone else's boots. So the Chashulchan writes, it's okay. Since that's the custom, it's not considered to be gezel, and they will switch their boots back when they see each other in the morning. So too would apply to a shenko according to the Aruch HaShulchan. I skipped question 10. If one cannot keep up the davening tefillah on Monday and Thursday, is it preferable to say more of the hurachim or to say the extra insert that's added to the tachlon Hashem Elokei Yisrael? Does not know how much he will be able to say. Can he say the tachlon tefillah apayim first and as much of the hurachim afterwards? Two interesting questions. I don't think you should skip anything. Just go straight. Don't make the nefilas apayim. That's the suksvar. Ashkenaz does the hurachim first. But what will happen if I see that I'm still halfway through and everyone else is finished? They're all going down nefilas apayim. I recommend then you go down nefilas apayim right then and there. Otherwise, they will be saying, Kaddish, you're still in the middle of hurachim. You'll lose out on the whole nefilas apayim, which is really the main point of the tachanun. So either immediately or shortly thereafter, when they put their heads down on the table, you should do the same thing. And if you want to make up later, you can, but not completely necessary. Rav Shechter Shalita says he can't keep up. He divides Vurachim into three segments. Three. And this way, he's able to, within three Mondays and Thursdays, he'd be able to finish. That's his hanaga, as an Adam God of old. But most people don't do it that way. They will just say as much as you can. And then when they're going down, you should go down immediately or shortly thereafter. So she'll be able to at least finish the Nefilas HaPayim before the Kaddish is recited. Kei Nira. Question number 12. Is it permissible on Shabbos to put a piece of wood in the track of a sliding glass door to prevent someone from opening it from the outside? Absolutely, yes. It's not going to say to be bona. It's not tight, and it's not doing anything new. In my opinion, that's completely permissible. 13. A person showers often and finds it difficult to go without showering on Yom Tov. Is it permissible for him to take a lukewarm shower and wash his entire body on Yom Tov? Maybe use liquid soap or shampoo to allow it to dry his hair with a towel. This is the whole discussion. In my view, even a hot shower is permissible today on Yom Tov, even though the Gemara says it's prohibited. What changed? Well, the two reasons why a person cannot bathe with hot water on Yom Tov. One is it's eino shava l'chol nefesh. It's something which most people don't do. And most people don't do the Gemara says in Ksubis, that's not considered to be included in ochol nefesh. It's ochol nefesh hashava l'chol nefesh. That may have been true then, but today in America, people shower every single day. The vast majority of people take a daily shower. You look in the various surveys. And therefore, it is shava l'chol nefesh. Therefore, strictly speaking, should not be a problem. There's another pshat, the Rambam holds, it's gzeres habalonet. Same way as on Shabbos, they made gzeres not to bathe in hot water because there were unscrupulous bathhouse attendants who would cook up the water on Shabbos and claim it was from Erev Shabbos to put them out of business. They said, no one goes to a hot bath at all on Shabbos, no matter when it was heated. That is gzeres habalonet. However, many poskim say it's only in a public shower that they used to have in the old days. Because then, you know, it's in someone's hands. You never know what's going to happen. But it's a private shower in your own house? There's no gzeres habalonim because you're in charge completely. No one's going to make a mistake. And therefore, if that's the reason for the Easter of Yom Tov, it wouldn't apply in a private shower either. So technically speaking, one can argue strongly that it should be permissible according to strict halacha. However, the problem is that there is a universal minhag quoted by the Mishnah Berurah Siman Shin Chavav Sivkon Chav Aleph, and the Magen Avraham already said it earlier, that you can't bathe in even cold water. Why not? The primary reason being is going to come to Schita. You want to squeeze out the towel, some of that hair, which is the problem. Schita. That's why our custom remains not to do this. Rav Moshe is a little bit lenient. He says a shower not the same as a bath. We assume that it is. But someone who's very, very severe pain, he calls them a star, harbe, not just plain with star, a star harbe, the post came out been lenient. You're looking the if you look in the Piskei Teshuvos, footnote 109 and 110, he quotes that there are people who are makel from its star harbe. I'm very leery of using that description. Everyone has described it harbe. Moazim and Yordan, not everyone says it's an istis, can be taken that as a word. So I'm not quick to be mata these things. I tell people it's better not to take a shower at all on Yom Tov, even have to go 3 days sometimes. But those who are lenient have what to rely upon. So things have, in fact, changed. Can you use liquid soap? Yes. No problem. Liquid shampoo? Yes. But when you dry yourself, make sure you don't screen out the towel. That's a problem. That's one of the main reason why we don't shower in the first place. So don't go into bodies of water. It's because it may lead to schita. That's important to know. Rav Moshe, the tshuva, you may make it on Yom Tov because there's an additional reason given by the poskim. You may actually carry where the water is on your body. You walk for amos. It wouldn't apply on Yom Tov. But most poskim disregard that reason completely, and they're focused on the reasons which would apply on Yom Tov as possibility of leading to schita. Very old custom. We don't play with it lightly. 14. A married woman received a significant gift of stocks and funds from her mother's trust so as to minimize the trust tax exposure. If she obligated in giving meiser, and at one point, she made a wealth manager who advised her to sell off her current portfolio in a company A to enable her to invest different stocks in her funds with company B, which she says are more lucrative, in that they will produce more current income, additionally, more growth potential. Must she now only reinvest 90%? Who has the tovas and our rights of choosing which stock to give the meiser? The woman or her husband? Is the meiser like the payers? In general, is there a deadline by when the meiser money has to be distributed? They were just put into a separate meiser account, give it out slowly when he needs it. These are all good questions. Start from the beginning. The word obligated is not correct. Meiser Ksavim has four opinions. A Torah obligation, a rabbinic obligation, a minig obligation, because I'm going to talk about so widespread, or less than that, we pass in the fourth and most lenient view. It's a custom, but it's not even a binding custom. It never was accepted fully that everyone has to do that. And that's why the word obligated does not apply. And based upon that, once it's not obligated, there were those who maintained that we're not going to give from gifts the chlal. We give from our income, not from gifts, even though there's no fundamental difference between them. But if it's only considered to be a minig, which is not binding, there were those who actually accept that point of view. Of course, when it's possible, you can afford to give the meiser. Give it immediately. Give it immediately. It is important. Immediately. However, this is only true if the money was given in this trust, stocks, funds, for the total discretion of the daughter. But sometimes, if you look in Choshen Mishpat, Resh Mem Aleph Sif Hey, there can be a case in which the mother gave the stocks and bonds and trust to the daughter with the explicit understanding that she should not take meiser from it, rather use it all for a particular purpose or purposes as the years go by. Perhaps even if you don't have it explicit, there's an umdah zemuchah that the mother had in mind in certain cases. In certain cases. And therefore, what should happen? Should he only reinvest 90%? Well, in the case where the husband has authority over it, called Nichsei Maluk, Paris, then perhaps you only invest 90% in the Hana. Tovas Hana belongs to him. If the money is considered Nichsei Maluk, if you look carefully, in Ebenezer, Simon Pei Hei Sifir Aleph, if it's an explicit condition, I'm giving it to this married woman on the explicit condition that doesn't go to her husband at all, she should use it for something else. That, in fact, is effective. Look at the Simon Pei Ebenezer. I'm giving it to you. Do whatever you want. I'm giving it to you, Mrs. X. Do whatever you want without your husband intervening. That seems to be effective. It seems to me that if in the case of an umdra demuchach, it's clear as day that was the intention, then it perhaps would have been effective even if it was never enunciated explicitly. What about when must you give the meiser? Whenever your man meiser is. Some do Rosh Hashanah, some do it April 15th when they're doing their tax returns. There could be any day of the year that you pick as the time to give out the tzedakah. You may put in a special tzedakah account and you're not required to distribute it immediately. Just as long as you know that's in the account, whenever you need it, you have the ability to take from it to give to tzedakah. Okay, 15. On Shavuos, is there any preference of which suit to have milchus? How does this balance with the requirement of Simchas Yontif with Basar? So Simchas Yontif with Basar, in my opinion, is only an obligation once every 24-hour day. That's my view. Not everyone agrees. So it's only once a day. There's no problem. It's Mechus Yontif with Minchas. You have one meat meal and one milcha meal. No problem. No problem whatsoever as far as that is concerned. Nonetheless, many people like meat better, the greatest Mechus Yontif. And therefore, it seems to me the best of the four meals coming up next month, Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday. In our house, the typical year, we will make milchiks on Monday night, second night of Shavuos, for a variety of reasons. One, there are bonon yant of sheni, so better to have the milchik meal then. Two, by the time Monday night rolls around, we've had so much fleishiks on Sunday night and on Monday, and it's coming so close to Shabbos this year. So therefore, that's the best night, I believe, if you have to pick one of them, to have milchiks, but technically speaking, you can have milchiks for two meals, as long as you have the meat once each day of Yom Tov. 16. Someone ate a meal of chicken, peat, rice, pilaf, and vegetables. When he finishes eating, he's unsure if he ate a kazayas of the pasta and the rice pilaf mixture. He's too full to eat more. Should he also make an alamichya or only a borei nefashos? If you look on the Shulchan Aruch, Simon Reish Test of Gimel, it's quite clear that Me'ein Sholosh is a din derabonim. Alamichya is derabonim. Not everyone agrees. Mr. Bruce of Kod Nyod, some disagree. But nonetheless, Sfeika derabonim lakula, Savik brochos lahakal, make it only a bona fushes in this case. If you can't eat more, if you need more, could eat more power to you to eat more to be chayven alamichi for sure. Final question, number 17. A kohen bought a new oven with a star case Shabbos mode. A, on Shabbos when the oven is on in Shabbos mode, may one open the door and take out some of the food, or may they only open it once and remove all the food from the oven. B, on Yom Tov, if the oven is on, may one open the oven door only when the flame is currently on or even when it's currently off. C, on Yom Tov, may the temperature be changed as needed for Yom Tov when the display will not indicate the change in temperature and there is a time delay in the change. Okay, I'm not an expert in Shabbos mode, but we know that the main mover behind it is Rabbi Moshe Heineman Shalita. Rabbi Heineman has a psak, which I find to be untenable, but that's his psak, that if you have an oven, which is not the star K mode, a regular old oven, you may not take things out of the oven because when you take things out of the oven, it affects the thermostat and the oven fire will go on earlier than otherwise, which is a prohibition. Shabbos mode avoids that. My question against Rabbi Heineman Shlita is as follows. Don't we all do this? You open your door of your house in the wintertime and a gust of cold air blows in. That affects the thermostat. And that's going to make the central heating go on earlier than otherwise. How can we allow that? The answer is, if you look in Shulta Giborim, in the Masechta Shabbos, in the Sugya Daf Kuf Chof, he says, it's a psik reisha liachas man. Doesn't take effect right away. It's about later on when she says it's permissible. Here too, it's a psik reisha yachas man. I think Rabbi Eider wrote that he tried opening and closing the oven door. It took him 8 times until the fire finally went on again. You could hear it in the back of the oven. That's a today's ovens may be a little bit more sophisticated, but not immediately. I don't think it's that strong. It's not immediate. It seems to me it's permissible. And proof is you walk into your house in the winter, the same exact thing happens when the gust of cold air goes from the front door to the thermostat and enables the central heating to go on earlier. It seems to be a very similar situation. That's why I think it's completely permissible even without a Shabbos mode. Okay. So I think you take out half the food, leaving the other half of the food. Rabbi Heineman said, take all the food you don't care about anymore. Lo nichale. I think you can leave half the food in. That's not a problem, even without a Shabbos mode, even on Shabbos. Now, B is Yom Tov. the oven is on, if you open the oven door only when the flame is currently on or even when it's currently off. In my view, even if it's currently off, it's still no problem without any modes for the same reason as before. It's a psik ratio and it doesn't happen right away. C, on Yom Tov, the temperature will be changed as needed for the Yom Tov when the display will not indicate the change. That's apparently one of the achievements of the Shabbos mode, is to deactivate the display. Now, it's important to understand changing temperature is a problem, nothing to do with a display. To raise, to lower, and not simple. In a gas oven, which this may be, it's permissible to make the fire higher because presumably you're going to need it for your cooking and you're allowed to have aura for the purpose of cooking. That's clear. So it's no problem to make it higher. Lower? Not so complicated. Rav Moshe has this very remarkable tshuva, which he purposely, I believe, hides his opinion. He writes, someone asked about lowering the flame on Yom Tov. He says, you know what? If it's permissible to have it turned off completely, then you can lower it. And if it's not permissible to turn it off completely, you're not allowed to lower it. It's double or nothing. He doesn't tip his hand. What does he really think? The Messiah is that he thought it's permissible. Why? He viewed this as a grom aliyachas man. Because time lapses between the time that you turn the knob and the time that the fire goes out, because there's still some gas in the pipeline. In my view, it's too short of a time interval to be considered the Yachas Man. I think it's prohibited, and if you look in the more recent Svarim, they seem to all agree that it's not permissible to lower the flame on Yom Tov. Give a look in the Pesachei Teshuvah, Siman Tov Kuf Yud Dalet Oz Beis, unless it's a Torah HaTavshil. It shouldn't burn, that's for sure. But in most cases, that's not the case that we're dealing with. Interestingly, there are cases in which it's permissible, the Tzorach HaTavshel. What about if it's an electric range? He writes in Pesachei Teshuvah, Tov Kuf Zayin, Siv Beis, that it depends. If you're the Chazon Ish, then any electric is automatically forbidden on a Torah level, nothing is allowed. But he assumes that most poskim disagree with Chazon Ish and say that electricity in and of itself not necessarily a problem. And over here he claims, I'm not doing anything directly. Just that, because of what I am doing, what's going to happen? There's going to be less of a quote, fire in such a circumstance. And therefore, there is some reason to be lenient, even though it's fundamentally an electrical system. It's hard for me to fully grasp that. But in gas ovens, there's that svara. It's permissible when if you don't do it, the food's going to burn. Whole fight. What do you mean the food's going to burn? Light another fire and then put the pot on a lower fire. Not always feasible, not always possible, and not always necessary, according to the Mechilim, that you may take care of these things on Yom Tov. It's a little complicated, but it seems to me that we answered the question properly. Again, the whole Shabbos mode is a very nice idea, particular idea that we're discussing now about opening the oven when food is still in. I don't think requires the mode. Avoiding the display is certainly a good contribution of the Shabbos mode. I take this opportunity to wish everybody a Chag Shavuos Sameach. We answered some of the questions.
Thank you again, Rebbe. In 2 weeks and the following 2 weeks, we'll have two more in June, Mr. Rebbe.
Okay.